Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? Are you not servants of Saul?" Do you like the voice? I was practicing. "Choose a man and have him come down to me. And if he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." Then the Philistine said, "This day I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. So, there's a few things of that passage I just wanted to bring out, a few questions that it raised up. The first question is, why is there so much detail? Why does it matter between what hill and what city and where it all happened? Why is there so much detail around what Goliath was like and what he carried? And so the answer to that is actually because it shows us that it's true, that it actually happened, that there is actually this valley that you can go to, the Valley of Elah, and actually that's on the right of it, that's a picture of what it actually looks like. You can go to that valley, you can walk up to the stream, the riverbed, and you can pick up stones from it. It is an actual place, and these were actual people that it happened to. You know, we can get a bit blasé about, well, there was battles all the way through the Old Testament, but actually this was a real serious act of aggression on behalf of the Philistines. They were making their way towards the centre of the Israelite territory, and it had to be stopped. They couldn't be allowed to continue. They had to go out and confront them. So they're left with this stalemate between the Israelites and the Philistines, and as sometimes the custom, they would find a champion and they would fight each other to try and save some of the bloodshed. But this guy was big. This guy was seriously big. I've asked for Reuben to be a helper. If he about? Where's Reuben? Right, we're going to demonstrate how big Goliath was. He unfortunately didn't actually get to tell him what he was going to do. Right, come here. Right. I've got a tape measure. Right. Now, Reuben, you're quite a tall person. That's about, 6 foot? About that?
Something like that.
Yeah, it's not big enough. Right, come over here. Right, sit on my shoulders. Right, turn around. Right, there you go. Right, can you take it up a bit higher? Actually, I need another person. Have we got a David here? David Lowe, you'll do. Hold on to that, Reuben. Reuben! Reuben! Right, now David, I need you to hold. I need you to hold that down on the floor. Right, hold it on the floor. Make sure it's touching the floor, that's it. Right, how high is that now, Reuben? As high as you can go. Is that 3 metres, something like that?
Really, we're 8 foot 5.
8 foot 5. So even you on my shoulders, right, so okay, you can let go of the tape measure now. So you stand here, David. So even David, next to me, with Reuben on my head, that's still not as tall as Goliath was. He was a big guy. I reckon 9 foot 9 inches. Okay, I'll let you go down. There you go. Thank you. Round of applause for my volunteers. So they reckon about 3 metres, 9 foot 9, something like that. This guy was big. He was tall. And he wasn't, I mean, the thing that came to me was, remember the Guinness Book of Records? And you see that black and white photos of the American guy who was seriously tall. But he was quite scrawny and needed sticks to walk around. He wasn't big like that. This guy was buff. He was meaty. He'd been working out. So he was, it talks about having like bronze boots. Anyway, and how he had a spear that had, it said 500 shekels. That's like 15 pounds worth of iron point on the end. So I Googled 15 pounds and got lots of images of people holding fish. That's what came out. For 15 pounds, you get. But these fish that they were holding was two-handed, and they're struggling to hold these fish. And that's just the tip of his spear, and he could throw that with one hand. So this guy was seriously big, seriously powerful. The next question that came to mind was, why wasn't Saul standing up, making this challenge? Because if you look back, it says in 1 Samuel 10:24, it says that he was a head taller than all the other Israelites. So when he was crowned king, it's made a point that he's taller than all the others. So the natural champion to fight for Goliath would have been Saul. He would have been the one that they would turn to look to. And you could say, well, maybe it's a tactical decision. Maybe because he's a king, they don't want to put their king on the front line. But actually, again, you read back to the previous chapters, that's what the kings did. They were out there on the front line. Whether the king themselves or his son Jonathan, they were out there fighting, taking it to the enemy. Yet we find him with the Israelites marching their way up to the battle line. We find him back in his tent hiding. Why was that? Well, again, you look back a couple of chapters and you find out that due to the decisions that Saul made, he's got to the point now when Samuel has said, the Spirit has left you. God's Spirit that he was put on him when he was anointed into to be the king had gone. And so had Samuel, for that matter. So here was a king who had known what it was like to have God's Spirit in you every step of the way. And now that Spirit has stepped back and he was there on his own. A lonely place to be because God wasn't with him. But God was still with the Israelites. God had other plans. So we'll move on to verse 17. And it says, now Jesse said to his son David, take this ephah of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers and hurry to their camp. Take along these 10 cheeses to the commander of their unit. See how your brothers are and bring back some assurance from them. They are with Saul and all the men of Israel at the Valley of Elah, fighting against the Philistines. Early in the morning, David left the flock with a shepherd, loaded up and set out as Jesse directed. He reached the camp as the army was going out to its battle positions, shouting their war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines facing each other. David left his things with the keeper of supplies, ran to the battle lines and greeted his brothers. As he was talking with them, Goliath the Philistine, the champion from Gath, stepped out from the lines and shouted out his usual defiance, and David heard it. When the Israelites saw the man, they ran from him in great fear. Now the Israelites had been saying, do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give his daughter in marriage and will exempt his father's family from taxes in Israel. David asked the man standing there, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? You can see he's getting ground up by what Goliath is saying. They repeated what they had said and told him, this is what will be done for the man who kills him. When Eliab, David's older brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? Typical brother. Putting him down already. I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came only to watch the battle. And then a similar brotherly response. Now what have I done? Said David. Can't I even speak? He turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. So David comes onto the scene. Although he's been at Saul's court previously, helping to kind of subdue Saul's anger and his rages that he had, his services were no longer needed, and he then returns back to his home, back to his father, and starts looking after the sheep again. Which was strange, because he'd already been anointed to be king by the next king by Samuel. He then found himself in Saul's court. He's right there at the seat of power with the old king that he knew that he was going to be taking over from. And then suddenly he's back where he started. He's back at home with his father. But it doesn't seem to bother him. See, David seems to trust God. He seems to trust him with his future. He knows he can leave it to God because he's in control. He doesn't seem resentful. Doesn't seem to think, well, it's all fallen apart now. He just carries on doing what God's given him to do. And he also carries on obeying his father. He His father said, can you take these supplies to your brother? It's a fairly, usual job. They don't think they were paid as our armies are paid now. They had to be supported from home. So he did the job of taking the supplies. Some nice cheeses for the generals as well. Look after them. And just generally kind of look after them. And what do you know? Just as he turns out, they happen to be walking up to face the Philistines. Just at that moment. Whew, what a coincidence. So he says, right, he definitely said to go and check up, find out how they were. I better go up to the front line. So off he trots to the front line. And what do you know? Just at that point, Goliath comes out and starts saying slandering the Israelites, saying, good, and defying the gods of Israel. So he was in there at that moment at just the right time. And he gets getting angry. He can't understand why this person, this Philistine, is going to be allowed to defy the gods of Israel. So we're going to go to next to verse 38. Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic. He put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened the sword over the tunic and tried walking about because he was not used to them. I cannot go in these, he said to Saul, because I am not used to them. So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 small stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of the shepherd's bag, and with a sling in his hand approached the Philistine. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was only a boy, ruddy and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his God. Come here, and he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the fields. David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. Today I'll give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. Wow. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or by spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. As the Philistine moved closer to attack, David ran quickly towards the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag, he took out a stone and slung it, and it struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down to the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. David ran over, stood over him. He took out the Philistine's sword and drew it out from the scabbard. This is the guidance bit here. After he had killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. The men of Israel and Judah surged forward with a shout and pursued the Philistines all the way to the entrance of Gath and to the gates of Ekron. Their dead were strewn across the Shaaraim road to Gath and Ekron. When the Israelites returned from chasing the Philistines, they plundered their camp. David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, and he put the Philistine's weapons in his own tent. So, most of us know this part of the story quite well. The shepherd boy refuses the armoury that was offered to him and instead goes out in what he's used to. Goes down, gets a sling, 5 stones, runs towards the giant, flings the stone, direct hit, bang, centre of the forehead. Giant, unconscious, falls to the ground. Already defeated. But not just that. He then takes Goliath's own sword and cuts his head off with it. The Israelites cheer and rush towards the Philistines, who turn and run rather than agreeing to become slaves, as was agreed. The deal was, they're off, they're running. And they chase them all the way back to Gath, where Goliath had come from. And that's important as well, that he came from Gath. We'll come to that in a bit. And then he goes back and takes Goliath's head and takes it to Jerusalem. Okay, we'll come on to that a bit as well. That's important as well in a minute. See, that's the story. And we can take it as a historical account. We can take it as a nice story. We can take it as a historical account as to what happened. But actually, I think it's a bit different than that. There's my nice little picture of the actual battle going on. You can just about see it. You get some sort of idea of the size. You know, David was not a child, and yet that was the size difference. You see, David actually also points us towards Jesus. David's story, in many ways, is like an indicator as to what Jesus would later do. You see, there was a lot of similarities between them. For instance, they both had a common ancestry. It says in 2 Samuel 7, verse 12, you have Nathan the prophet talking to David later on in, as he's king. And it says, "When your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his king. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son." So it's talking now about Solomon, but Solomon's temple that he built didn't last forever. No, it's also talking about Jesus, about what Jesus did, saying your descendants, the throne of your descendants will continue forever. And we'll go on to a bit to how that happened. They both had humble beginnings as well. They were both born in Bethlehem. Bethlehem, not one of the biggest towns, in fact one of the smallest towns and one of the smaller tribes. So it wasn't, they both had this humble upbringing. They both also obeyed their father. In John 5, verse 19, Jesus said to them, "I tell you the truth, the Son can do nothing by himself. He can only do what he sees his Father doing, because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. For the Son, Father loves the Son and shows him all the things he does." So David was obedient to Jesse, and Jesus was obedient to his Heavenly Father, to God. And the last thing that they both have in common is they both defeated a strong enemy in an unexpected way. So what was the strong enemy that Jesus defeated? Well, like the Israelites, we are condemned to a future of slavery. In John 8, verse 34, Jesus says, "I tell you the truth, everyone who sins is a slave to sin." Being a slave to sin means being unable to stop ourselves from doing the wrong things. Being able to stop ourselves from doing things that hurt other people or that hurt God. That's what being a slave to sin is. And the Bible also says quite clearly that the wages of sin is death. You see, the problem with having a perfect God is there can be no evil in his presence. It's a bit like when you have oil and water. When you kind of mix, even if you shake it all up, mix it up, you leave it to settle, and they're separate. They can't mix. Or maybe for the scientists among you, matter and antimatter, they can't exist in the same place. It's just not possible. God and evil, they cannot physically be in the same place. So the future looks rather bleak for us. But we have a champion who stands up and faces death on our behalf. How did he overcome death? By dying, of all things. Not what you would have thought, but just like David used Goliath's own sword to defeat Goliath, Jesus used death to defeat death. He was the only one who didn't deserve to die. He was the only one who wasn't a slave to sin, yet he chose to die. He took that punishment, which effectively threw a stone at the forehead of death and knocked it unconscious, defeated him. But that's not all, though. You see, because he was also God, he had the ability to cross from death into life. Death could not hold him. So as he crossed from death into life, all the power of death was gone. like David cutting off the head of Goliath, that was it. That was the final nail in the coffin, if you like. Now, I mentioned earlier how it was important, this is a bit of an aside, how it was important that, or interesting that Goliath had come from Gath and that David took the head of Goliath to Jerusalem. You see, that was an unusual thing to do. Why would he take it to Jerusalem? You think, well, that's where everyone is. Actually, no. Jerusalem at that point is being run by the Jebusites, who were enemies of Israel. They were in Jerusalem at the time. So why would he take the head of Goliath to Jerusalem? Some would say it was like a warning, that this is what our God can do. Here is this massive head of this massive Goliath from Gath. You know, be afraid, you're next, kind of thing. And it might well be the case. You see, you had Goliath from Gath, but because they weren't in the city, David wouldn't have been able to get into the city. So you could stand to reason that the head would probably be put outside the city walls, maybe on a hill outside the city walls. And this Goliath from Gath's head could be put on a place that would become known as the place of the skull. Now, this is all conjecture, but potentially the place of Jesus' greatest victory, Golgotha, the place of the skull, where Jesus was crucified, could well have been the same place that was a memorial to what David had done. His greatest victory. The two could be the same place. I know there's talk about how it looked like a skull as well, but you know, it says he took it to Jerusalem, so it could well be. I'm not saying it is, but when I read that, I was like, wow, that's incredible. That kind of the whole tapestry of history all kind of coming together, it may well have been the case that those two places were linked, and God knew ahead what he was going to do in the future, how he was going to slay the ultimate enemy. So, does this victory automatically come to us? No, it doesn't. There is something that we have to do. Just like there was something that the Israelites had to do. The Israelites had to accept what David had done and run towards him to claim that victory. David couldn't have taken down the whole of the Philistines on his own. But when they saw that Goliath was defeated, the Israelites stood up and ran towards him. Likewise, we have to accept what Jesus has done for us. We need to admit that we have done wrong things, that we have sinned, if you like, that we have done things that have hurt God and have hurt those around us. We need to ask for forgiveness for that. We have to ask God to say, will you forgive me for the wrong things I've done? And finally, we have to follow. We have to follow Jesus into the victory that he's won. It's not a passive thing. You can't just sit there and just say, okay, that's great. It's something we actively have to do, as much as the Israelites had to actively go and claim the victory. And actually, that is what is happening this morning with the baptisms. The three girls that are getting baptized, that's like their battle cry. It's like they've seen the giant fall, and they've stood up and they've said, yes, that's for me. And they're running towards it. This is their declaration, their battle cry, if you like, to say, that's what's happening. And so that's what's such an exciting time for us as a church, to see people that have actually made that decision and said, yes, this is my champion. This is a person worth following, and this is what I'm going to do. It's a fantastic time. I think it's a fantastic time. Is it a fantastic time?
Yes.
Right. So as I start to come to the finish, I just want to say, actually, people think that it's complicated. People can often think that becoming a Christian is really complicated, but honestly, it's not. As I've just talked about, Jesus did it all. Jesus has done everything for us. He's done all the hard work. There's nothing special about me. about the people getting baptized, about any of us that are Christians here. We're simply people that can be confident in what Jesus has done for our future. All the Christians ever did here was decide that he was, he accepted what he did, what he said he was going to do. They admitted what they'd done stuff wrong. They asked for forgiveness and they decided to follow him. That was it. But it starts with realizing that there is a champion. That there is a champion who's done it all. And there is somebody worth following. So what are you going to do? Are you going to sit there in slavery? Or are you going to step into the victory? Step into the freedom that Christ has for you. Now, I don't know many of you, I don't know where you are, but there might be people here that have never stood up and said, yes, that's for me. There might be people here that have said, might say, well, I think I did, but I'm not sure. And I'll say, actually, if the band start to come up, actually, if there is anyone, a baptism is a perfect time to stand up and be counted and say, today in Shepparton, I choose to step into that victory. I don't want to be a slave anymore. I don't want to be a slave because I have a champion. I have a victor who has done something amazing, who has stood in the face of death, thrown the stone into the forehead, and caused it to crash to the ground defeated. That's the God that I believe in, and that's the God that you can follow, one that has done all that for you. So as they start to play the song, if that's for you, if you want to now stand up from the ranks and go to the front of the battle line and say, yeah, I choose today to make this stand, then I'll give you that opportunity. There'll be people at the front that you can pray with that will happily talk to you about it, and then we can move into the baptism and celebrate what those people have done. Thank you very much.